Tour Jazz, session number 30, special Rosh Hashanah edition. This is going to be a mystery edition. We're going to try to solve a mystery today. Rosh Hashanah is coming up, and we want to understand what Rosh Hashanah is all about. So, if we want to understand what a certain holiday is all about, we got to go back to the source. So we take out our Chumash, we open it up, we start flipping through the different sections that mention the holidays, and we notice that there is no such holiday in the entire Chumash as Rosh Hashanah. It's a mystery. Where did Rosh Hashanah go to? But if you're observant, if you're an observant Jew, you notice that there is another holiday that comes out on the very same day where we would expect to find Rosh Hashanah, and that is the first day of the month of Tishrei. That holiday is called Yom Truah or Yom Zichron Truah, a day of blowing, a day of remembrance through blowing. That instead is the holiday that we find. And we do a little bit of math. We know that there's a idea, a mitzvah, of blowing a shofar on Rosh Hashanah. We're commanded to blow a shofar. That's part of the day. And this day is all about blowing a shofar. So we put two and two together and we realize this is the missing holiday of Rosh Hashanah. But then that raises a new question, which is, if in the Chumash this holiday is referred to as Yom Truah, a day of blowing, why did our sages decide to give it an entirely different name, Rosh Hashanah, the head of the year? Now, in the Chumash itself, there are multiple names given to different holidays. And sometimes our sages will choose one name over the other, depending on the idea they want to express, if they want to call it Chag HaPesach, if they want to call it Chag HaMatzot, if they want to call Shavuos Chag HaBikurim, or Sukkos Chag HaSukkot, Chag HaAsif. There are different names in the Chumash, and sometimes our sages will choose different names to express different ideas. But Rosh Hashanah is the only holiday, the only moed, the only time of year which is given a name which appears nowhere in the Chumash. So where does this name Rosh Hashanah come from? Where does it appear? So if you're a little bit craftier, you'll start moving your way all the way through Tanakh, and you will realize that it does appear in one place in the whole of Tanakh. So if you made it there, you would have gotten to the book of Yechezkel, the prophet Ezekiel, chapter 40, verse 1. And over there, in the book of Yechezkel, it tells us all about the prophecy of Ezekiel coming to him in the Babylonian exile. It says over there that the prophecy came to him on the 10th day of the month of Tishrei, Rosh Hashanah. So we were hoping that that would help us, but instead it seems like we've been thrown for another loop. Because we were expecting, I believe, to find the idea of Rosh Hashanah in Tanakh next to the first day of the month of Tishrei. And instead, when we get to the book of Yechezkel, chapter 40, verse 1, in Yechezkel's prophecy, we're told that the 10th day of the month of Tishrei is called Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of the year. And we have to understand why, if the Tanakh is calling Rosh Hashanah the 10th day of the month, why did our sages decide that that day somehow expressed so deeply the idea of Yom Truah, the first day of the month of Tishrei, that they borrowed that name over there and applied it to our day, the first of the month of Tishrei? Now, getting through the different ideas in Rosh Hashanah is tough, because Chazal are hiding a lot of things in plain sight for us. And if a person says, okay, I made it through Chumash, I see that the name Rosh Hashanah doesn't exist. It's only Yom Teruah. So they make it all the way through Tanakh, and they find that the name Rosh Hashanah exists in Yechezkel, but exists over there by the 10th of the month, which is Yom Kippur. So then they open up some Mishnayos, hoping to get a little bit of clarity on what this idea of Rosh Hashanah is all about. And the first thing they find out when they open the first Mishnah is that indeed there are four different Rosh Hashanahs. That's right, not one, but four. There's a Rosh Hashanah for kings. There's a Rosh Hashanah, kings and regalim and pilgrimages together. There's a Rosh Hashanah for tithing animals. There's one for years. There's one for trees. So we have four different Rosh Hashanahs, and our Rosh Hashanah is none of them. And then we go to the next Mishnah, Mishnah 2, and we find that there are four times, four prakim, four joints, four connection places where the world is judged. The world is judged for produce on Pesach. It's judged for fruit on Shavuos. And then all of a sudden, the Mishnah changes its tone and says that all the Boi Olam, all the people of the world, pass like B'nai Marum, like sheep through a tight narrowing on Rosh Hashanah. Oh, there it is. Our sages have finally used that phrase in connection with the day we know, Rosh Hashanah. But they use it as though it's the only Rosh Hashanah in the world. They don't tell us which Rosh Hashanah. They just say, on Rosh Hashanah, as though there's only one. And the other shocking thing is that it's not in the list of Rosh Hashanahs. Rather, it's in the list of prakim, of these joints, of these points during the year, as opposed to being in the heads of the year. And fourth in the list is Shavuos, where we're judged on fruit. Now, I just wanted to put a lot of questions out there. Maybe the questions are better than the answers. We'll do our best to try to answer up a lot of these questions, and at the very least, try to get a strong sense as to why the sages chose the name Rosh Hashanah for this day, what exactly they were trying to teach us through calling it Rosh Hashanah, and to answer the question why this day, the 10th day of Tishrei, is in fact an appropriate day to represent the idea of Rosh Hashanah. Okay, a little clue, maybe, to get us going, is there's also a Gemara in Megillah, which is going to help us to answer a little bit our questions on the second Mishnah. The Gemara in Megillah, it's the second page from the end, Folio B, over there tells us that the Parshios, the weekly Torah readings, are ordered to fall out next to certain times of year. And the curses are always meant to come out before the end of the year. So the curses in Bechukosai always come out before Shavuos. And the curses in Kisavo, which we read last week, come out before Rosh Hashanah. And understanding why they were ordered that way, Abaye comes along and tells us, Tichle Shana, Tichle Klaloseya, the year should finish off and should finish off all the curses with it. And the Gemara then has a question. Okay, so for this week's past week's Parsha, Kisavo, lining up with Rosh Hashanah, the head of the year, that we understand. It's the end of the year. But why are we connecting Bechukosai over to Shavuos? Is Shavuos a Rosh Hashanah? The Gemara is genuinely confused. How can we call Shavuos a Rosh Hashanah? And the Gemara says in the affirmative, yes, as a matter of fact, Shavuos is a Rosh Hashanah. Why? Because that's the day when fruit is judged. Remember, we said the four times of the year when different things are judged. So one clue that Chazal are throwing our way, maybe it helps us, maybe it confuses us more, is that a time when something is judged is called a Rosh Hashanah. So in fact, those four prakim, those four joints, those four points, those four connections that we talked about in the second Mishnah are in fact all Rosh Hashanahs. So that at least helps us a little bit to understand what Rosh Hashanah is doing there, although we still need to understand why they're called Prakim and not Rosh Hashanah like the first Mishnah expressed them. And we're also going to have to understand now a little bit why Din, why judgment, a time of judging, why that defines something as a Rosh Hashanah, why does that make it a Rosh Hashanah? Okay, so now we're going to have to roll up our sleeves and start to dig in. And the first question we're going to have to ask ourselves, now that we've pulled up all the evidence that we could use, we're going to have to reach into our own resource bank and try to understand things. So what is a Rosh? Right? If that's the name that our sages wanted to express so deeply, the idea of this day of blowing, so what is it about a Rosh Hashanah, which is so much better than calling it a day of judgment, right? Or the beginning of the year, right? Shana Chadasha, a new year, right? Like, Happy New Year, right? That would have been good. Why did our sages insist on calling it head of the year? So, if we're trying to understand what's a head mean, so we know that head sometimes can mean the beginning of something. Like, Rabbi Yehuda Rosh Medabrim Bikol Makom, he's the first of the speakers in all places. Or the first word in the Torah, right? Bereshit, in the beginning. So this word Rosh could mean the beginning of something, which would imply that Rosh Hashanah is a beginning. And if that were true, that would be a good start for us at least. We'd understand that Rosh Hashanah means the beginning of a year. We'd still have to understand why we're using the word Rosh instead of Hatchala, but okay. At least for us, it's a beginning. Okay, great. So now if we look in the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah on page 10, folio B, we see that there are actually two very critical, important months in the Jewish year. I mean, I guess every month in the Jewish year is critical, right? But two particularly outstanding months. And those months are the months of Nisan and Tishrei. And if we were looking in the Torah, at least, for a source for the beginning of a year, instinctively, we would all lean towards Nisan. Because we see that in the Chumash, in the book of Exodus, Shmos, chapter 12, verse 2, we have a commandment. We're told that Nisan is Rosh Chadashim, that we're supposed to look at Nisan as the first of the months of the year, and we count all the months from Nisan. So before the months were given names after the Babylonian exile, they were just called the first month, the second month, the third month, the fourth month, and that counting started from Nisan. So if we had to pick a Rosh Hashanah, if the idea of Rosh meant the beginning, the start of something, certainly it would have been more appropriate to choose Nisan for that month, which is the beginning. And if you start counting from Nisan, what you see is that Tishrei is actually just in the middle of the year. Tishrei, the month that Rosh Hashanah is in the middle of the year, and nowhere near the beginning of the year. Okay, over there, we have a disagreement about certain events, and which events occurred in the month of Tishrei, and which events occurred in the month of Nisan. So everybody agrees that Tishrei, the month that we are coming up to for Rosh Hashanah, was the time that Sarah, Rachel, and Chana, their prayers to become pregnant were answered, right? Hashem remembered them, and at that point, they merited to have children. It's also the day, according to everybody, that Yosef is released from his 2 years in prison. And now, other than that, everybody agrees that Nisan, the month that Pesach occurs in, is the month when Yitzchak was born. And it was the time of the first Exodus when all the Jews left Egypt. Now, what Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer disagree about are a few other events. Let's start with Rabbi Yoshua. According to Rabbi Yoshua, the world was created in the month of Nisan. It was also when all the forefathers, but really three fathers, but in this case just two fathers, Avram and Yaakov, were born in that month of Nisan. And it's also the month of the future redemption. It is the time when Mashiach will come and the third temple will be built. That all that goodness happens in the month of Nisan. Now, according to Rabbi Eliezer, all those things happen in Tishrei. The world is created. The world was created in Tishrei. And the final redemption will happen in Tishrei. And Avram and Yaakov were born in the month of Tishrei. Okay, good. But the thing is that we all agree that this Zichron Trua, this blowing of the shofar, that happens on Tishrei. They disagree when the world was created. They disagree about the final redemption. But they all agree that there's a holiday, right? There's a moed in the Chumash where we blow the shofar, and that happens on the first of Tishrei. So according to Rabbi Yoshua, if we went according to Rabbi Eliezer, now we have a beginning. It's nice and easy because we say what happened on Tishrei, that was a beginning. Well, it was beginning of the world, right? That's the day that the world was created. Or really the day that man was created, because that's the point of relevance. By if anything's going to be judged, it's only because the existence of man, because man is the only creature creation that has the ability to choose between right and wrong. So the beginning of the world history, as we understand it, which is really the sixth day of creation, the day that man is created, that's Bereshis, that's Rabbi Eliezer, and that would be really nice and easy. But we still have to consider Rabbi Yoshua, because Rabbi Yoshua understood that the world was created in Nisan and not in Tishrei. And so therefore we have to ask Rabbi Yoshua this question. So according to you, what's so special about this seventh month of the year, where nothing exactly happened? Why do we blow a shofar on that day? And we're going to run with Rabbi Yeshua's approach, because it'll give us the strongest understanding of what Rosh Hashanah is all about. So what do we see according to Rabbi Yeshua? That Tishrei, the month coming up, falls out in the middle of the year. If we start counting from Nisan, Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, Av, Elul, Tishrei, Tishrei is the seventh month from the beginning of the year. So in what way is the seventh month going to be a Rosh? If anything, it seems like it's going to be a belly button. So the Maharal, in his Chidushei Agados, explains that actually there are two types of heads, two types of Rosh. When you begin a new project, when you start building something, you start creating something, the first thing that you need to have in place before you do anything else is a power source in order to be able to move forward. So just to get some examples from the world when we talk about this idea, so if you talk to a cell biologist going down to the cellular level, they will all tell you that life had to begin with the mitochondria. The first thing that has to get everything started is the energy source, because how are you going to build up if you don't have an energy source to keep things going? Or if you want to go to an anatomical level, when a fetus, an embryo, is developing, so the first thing that is being built is the circulatory system and some sort of rudimentary heart. Once the body gets too big to absorb oxygen through diffusion, it needs to create a circulatory system in order to pump oxygen throughout the body. So when we start to build something, when we're creating something, we're at the beginning stages of something, the first thing that needs to happen, the beginning of it, right, this type of a Rosh, is really the heart. It's the engine that pumps fuel that allows us to develop whatever we need to do. So Nisan, right, that type of a head is going to be the heart of the Jewish year. If you look at what's happening in the world in springtime, it's a time where things are coming to life. It's a time where animals are mating. It's a time when the crops are starting to blossom. The flowers on the trees are starting to blossom. Nisan is that time where life is being pumped into the world. It's an abundance of chesed, an abundance of kindness. It's a straight shot being delivered to us of just life flowing into this world. It's a time of birth, right? It's the time the Jewish people were born as a nation. But there is a second type of a Rosh. When we talk about Rosh Shivtei Yisrael, Rosh Midian, Rosh Meshech Betuval, right? The head of a tribe, the head of a nation. We obviously can't mean the first, because if a person's considered the head of a nation or the head of a class, can't mean that he's the beginning. That's not the whole significance of it. There's a greater significance of it. It means that this person's in control. He has rulership. He's considered the greatest, the leader, the vision, whatever it is. And here, as a matter of fact, we have a very interesting Targum Yerushalmi. That same word Bereshis, which we spoke about, that Bereshis is the idea that in the beginning, this idea of Tchila, of the start of something. But the Targum Yerushalmi gives a different definition. It gives a translation for the word Bereshis as Bechachmata, with wisdom, with intelligence. So there's a second type of Rosh, which is the brain. The brain is the thing that controls this greater body. Now here, in opposition to the heart, the brain is the one of the last things that's actually developed in the human embryo. It doesn't happen till the last trimester, because a body which isn't complete has no use for a brain. So Tishrei, unlike Nisan, is the brain of the year. It's the head in that sense. So Nisan is the head in the sense that it's the first thing. It pumps life into this project. But Tishrei is the brain. It's the organization. It's the vision. It's the structure of the year. So that helps us understand why Tishrei actually falls out where it does in the calendar, which is with the number 7. 7, everywhere we see it in Judaism, represents shlemus, completion, something which is already been finished, and we can look at it in retrospect to understand how all the different pieces fit together. So we could look at it, we can think of it with a Shabbos example. And sevens, of course, come up everywhere in the Chumash, not just Shabbos, Shemitah, the Shemitah years, the sabbatical years, the days of purity of the Nida woman. There's a lot of sevens all over the Chumash. But if we look at it, the structure of a week, we have this idea that we have the 6 days, and the seventh day is the day where we can look back, understand everything that we've constructed up until now, and get an idea of what we have. So Tishrei, in a sense, is the Shabbos of the year. The Gimel Regalim, right? The three pilgrimages, as we spoke about in the second Mishnah there in Rosh Hashanah, they're three prakim, they're three joints, they're three legs that connect and hold the whole world up. And each one is at a different phase in the cycle of the year. The Maral in Gvuras Hashem, where is that? It's in chapter 40 something. It's in the 40s. The Maral in Gvuras Hashem gives a description of the pilgrimage months, and points out that when the pilgrimage months are mentioned in the Chumash, they're mentioned together, and they're mentioned with the time of year. Each one is specific to a time of year, with Pesach corresponding to the spring, Shavuos corresponding to the summer, And Sukkah is corresponding to the fall, the time of Asif, of bringing things in. And the Maral says it's no coincidence that these festivals follow different crop cycles during the year, different agricultural events during the year. We understand that change in this world occurs in the physical world, right? And there's also seven directions in space that the Maral mentions often. That is to say, there's east, west, north, south, up, down, or right, left, front, back, up and down. Those are the six directions which anything moves in physical space. And the seventh is the absolute center. And the seventh is always a level of connection to spirituality, because the center is always equidistant from all the points, no matter where you move. And so movement is felt there the least. That's an idea that corresponds to spirituality, since spirituality is not a physical state, it's a state without movement. So just like there's those 7 points in space, there's going to be 7 points in time, because as the Maral expresses in many places, it was already very clear, certainly to the Maral. I don't know how widespread the idea was in the world of philosophy, although I assumed that even secular philosophers had already understood this point, that space and time always move together, that time is just in fact a result of things moving through space. So that's why the 3 points of time during the year correspond to these changes that actually correlate to 3 points, 3 moments in the cycle of human development reaching its potential. So Nisan, we spoke about, is a time of tremendous chesed. That's when all of God's love and abundance and life flows into the world. That all reaches its ripeness at the time of Shavuos, right? That's when the fruits are ripe now on the tree. They're ripe for the picking. So we had the beginning when all the chesed, the goodness, flows in. We have the time where things reach their ripeness. And then we have this Chag HaOsif, Sukkot's time, where now we have to plan for the future. We have to bring all the crops in order to store them successfully moving forward. So the Maral describes this idea in 2 different ways. One way that he talks about it is, of course, the cycle of growth that a person goes through. That first a person receives chesed from Hashem. That chesed builds until it reaches fruition, right? It becomes ripe. And then for him to reach that higher level of connection to Hashem, he has to find a way to bring it back in to store it. So if you talk about the human life cycle, the idea of birth, basically receiving, using and receiving all your strengths, and then in order to reach a higher level of connection, you have to go bring everything back to the source. Everything has to go back to Hashem. It has to lose its body in order to go higher. The Maral also connects this idea to the idea of the 3 pillars upon which the world stands. That's the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. It says the world stands on 3 pillars, and those pillars are Gemilas Chasadim, doing kindness with others, Avoda, right, service, divine service, and Torah, and the learning of Torah. And those are going to correspond to these 3 festivals as we described it. All the chesed, the kindness that flows into the world, that's going to be Pesach, the time where all of Hashem's life flows into the world. Torah, of course, is going to correspond with Shavuos, the time where we receive the Torah. That's a time of tremendous closeness to Hashem. We've taken all that chesed and we've brought it to the next level of connection. We've gone higher. And then ultimately, the idea of avoda, of divine service, which is on Sukkot, where we bring a tremendous amount of korbanos, of sacrifices, and most significantly, it's the only time of the year where we can actually bring water and pour it onto the altar. We're even able to connect water back to Hashem. It's the idea of a sifut, of bringing things back to their source, of going to the next level. So those three legs. Those are the three pillars. They're called regalim, right? The same word as reglayim, as legs, because that's what the world really stands on, and that's why the Mishnah wants to refer to them as prakim. And in a sense, Rosh Hashanah itself is also a perek, but it's distinct and different from those three prakim that we mentioned. Unlike these three pilgrimages, festivals, legs that we spoke about, Rosh Hashanah is something else. It is the seventh point, which is that point that always connects to Kedusha, to holiness. It's connecting to things on a higher level. Rosh Hashanah is the time where the king is on his throne, where Hashem sits and judges the world. Now, if there's a king and he's sitting on his throne, that means the world has Seder. There's an order. There's an intelligence, a supreme intelligence, beyond our grasp, that put all of these things in their order, created the world to run in the way it does, with a certain function in mind. And now we start to understand why this day of Din, this time of judgment, can only happen when we reach the seventh month. Because if we want to understand how well you've maximized the potential you've been given, well, we can't look at that in the month of Nisan, where all that potential is only flowing into the world for the first time. We can't look at it even in Sivan, where you're now finally starting to piece it together, to bring that to its potential, to have that high of connecting to Hashem. So it's only when we reach Tishrei, this fall time, the time where all of this potential that you've been given has finally come to a place where you can look retrospectively at what you have. We can actually get a full picture of how you've used the 6 months leading up to now, just like the seventh of Shabbat allows us to look back at how we've used our movements through space-time during the 6 days of the week and get a big picture on Shabbat. So too, Rosh Hashanah is our first time we hit a seven. It creates the ability for us to look back and realize how have we used all the potential that Hashem has given us throughout the year up until this point. So Din comes automatically at the first ability that we have to actually see things played out, their potential finally being used. So in that way, we're seeing again why Rosh Hashanah, even according to Rabbi Yoshua, when it falls out on the seventh month, because seven is that time for connecting the dots, looking back and understanding how we use the potential, is the natural time when Hashem would sit on his throne of glory and judge the world, judge mankind, to see how well they've used all those gifts that Hashem has given them. And with this concept, with this new piece of information, seeing Rosh Hashanah as the Rosh, not as the beginning, but as the brain, as the representation of a structure, of finally putting together the pieces and seeing what we've been able to make out of them, we can actually maybe get a glimpse into why our sages chose this name, Rosh Hashanah, to represent this time of year. So we've been focusing on Rosh. We've been focusing on that aspect of the name Rosh Hashanah. But there's a second word in that name, which is Ha-Shana. And the word Shana, as the Maharal points out over there in his Chiddush HaGadlos, comes from the word Mishnah, to repeat. Because the year is really a cycle. And if we look at the cycle of the year, meaning we're following the solar cycle, the world does a rotation, comes back 365 degrees to the same spot, the same sun every day, coming up, going down, coming up, going down. And even though the length of those ups and downs change, but then after a year they go back to being the same. And obviously there are slight variances, but not to the extent, for example, of the moon, where the moon's phases are constantly waxing and waning. And it's interesting to note that our sages do go with Rabbi Yehoshua for calculating the tkufos, that is the complete cycle of the earth going around the sun until the sun is in the exact same location, which happens once every 29 years. And they go with Rabbi Eliezer when it comes to Mu'adim, which is the lunar cycle. We go with Rabbi Eliezer, and that actually makes a lot of sense with everything we're saying about the month of Nisan and the month of Tishrei. But for our purposes, a shana, a year, is this cycle, which repeats itself. It goes around and around and around over and over and over again. And as we spoke about in Parshas Kisavo, with the idea of the Bikurim, the idea of the Samech, the letter Samech, which is a perfect circle, wraps around itself over and over and over again, represents the idea of the Satan, the idea of the Yetzer Hara. And now we can understand why, because it represents this idea of nature. And the problem with nature, the place where the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, really takes a strong foothold, is that comes this time of year, comes Tishrei, and a person is left with a certain conundrum, which is to say that if I have been transgressing for 30 years of my life, 40 years, 50 years, whatever it is, 20 years, there's a certain mitzvah, there's a certain transgression I struggle with, there's a certain character trait that I haven't been able to change. Well, if we look at the natural world, we see that the world is a cycle. And if I behaved a certain way yesterday, why should I assume that I can behave differently tomorrow? That is to say, for 30 years, I have been struggling with the same exact problem. How can I possibly change, be different, come tomorrow? That's the struggle of the Satan. That's the circle. I see that everything is a cycle. Things repeat themselves. So how can I break that cycle? And if you look at a circle, so a circle is complete. It has no rosh. There's no point where you could say that's the beginning of the circle. There's no intricate design to a circle. If you put down a compass, and when I say compass, I'm referring to the one that we used to have in trigonometry and geometry, that, you know, you put the needle in the middle and then you follow it with a pencil. Once the circumference is set, you move the pencil, you already know where it's going to end up. There's no course alteration. Whereas if a person starts with a line, you don't know where that line's going to end, how long, how short, if it's going to veer, if it's going to stay straight. So that circle is the idea of having no rosh, no clear higher hierarchy or plan. And that's why Nisan cannot be a time of din. It's a time of chesed. It's a time of potential coming in. It's the beginning of a cycle. But we need to receive that material, that chesed, that flow that comes into the world. And we need to use it, try to bring it to its full potential. And we reach that seven, that time where the king sits in his throne, and we have the opportunity to realize that this world has a rosh. There's a structure, there's a plan, there's something higher, there's a greater intelligence that I can grab onto that exists beyond this circle and this cycle. So the word shana tells me that everything just repeats itself, and if I was this way today, I'll be the same way tomorrow. But the word rosh says, wait a second, a shana has a rosh. There's a seven. There's a connection to structure, to intelligence, to something higher. If Hashem created this world for people to be able to choose between right and wrong, and he gave you everything you need this year to be able to choose between right and wrong, that means that you are not trapped in a cycle. You're not trapped in a loop. You can change. And I believe that's why, that's my, what I'm going to put forward to everybody. The reason our sages call this time of year Rosh Hashanah is because a person shouldn't think that a Shana is a Mishnah, just a repetition, but rather they need to connect to this idea to Rosh, to become something greater and to connect to something greater. So let's go try to answer up some of the questions that we asked earlier. We spoke about the fact that the four prakim, the four joints, the four points in which the world is judged, and we mentioned how Rosh Hashanah there seems to be different. It's the Rosh Hashanah. We're speaking about people, the language changes. But the fact that the other three regalim, the other three festivals are called a Yom HaDin, we see as well that even though we haven't reached our full potential, but we've reached little mini potentials along the way, each point in time in accordance with the flow that comes into the world during that time. And since that's when we've reached the point where we have all the materials we need to move forward at that point, each one of those becomes a point of din. But they are just prakim, and the ultimate perek, the ultimate piece, which is really the root from which all these other days grow out of, expand out of, has to be Rosh Hashanah, which is the day where the king sits in his throne, where everything reaches its completion. And it's through that day that these other days draw power, and they become a mini Rosh Hashanah, a mini day of judgment, each one in its own right. But the Chumash refers to it as a day of blowing, and it's a day of shofar. And I want to take this idea that we've been speaking about and connect it over to the idea of shofar, to the idea of blowing, and see maybe how it all connects into everything that we've been speaking about. Now, something that's very interesting, following this discussion that we've been having over here, is that a shofar comes from the horn of an animal. And if anything, maybe you would think, if it's all about Rosh, we would want to take out some chunk of the animal's head itself, maybe, and blow into that. But instead you say that we're very specifically taking something, a part of it, the animal, that sits above their head. It's a bone that protrudes beyond. Now there's something interesting about bones over here, and it's actually a beautiful Ramban which is very easy to skip over. But if we have the sensitivity, trying to understand the things we're understanding right now, your antennas are up, they're tingling, then you spot this Ramban and see that it's actually saying something quite remarkable. So the Ramban I'm talking about is in Parshas, is in the book of Vayikra, the book of Leviticus. It's in Parshas Emor, and it's towards the end of the Parsha, where we start, middle to end of the Parsha, where we start talking about the different holidays that come up throughout the year. The Ramban actually, in trying to understand the two verses, we're over in chapter 23, once it appears by Shavuos, once it appears by Yom Kippur, is this phrase, Ta'asu lo ta'asu, right, v'chol malacha lo ta'asu be'etzem hayom hazeh. This idea of etzem hayom, and the Ramban brings a bunch of different midrashim to try to understand what this word etzem means. And etzem, it means the goof of the thing itself. That is to say, it has to occur during the day. It can't start before and finish after, meaning that it overlaps the day. It has to happen entirely in the day itself. And in trying to understand the root, the source of this word, etzem, the Ramban says that the etzem of a thing, the thing itself, is its koach, its kocho v'tukfo, its potential, its strength. And he brings it a verse in Dvarim, Kochi v'otzem yadi, the strength and the power of my hand. Oz v'tatzumot, this idea that otzem, that otzma, is power or strength, the entirety of the power or the strength of that thing. And he brings a reason for that idea, which is that word, the word etzem, which means a bone, that the atzamot, the bones, are the structure upon which the body builds its potential, its force. Now, the Ramban also brings the translation for this word, etzem, in the Targum Onkelos, which is the word kran, or a keren. So a keren is everything that we've been speaking about. A keren is a horn. And specifically, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah tells us that the shofar cannot just be any part of the body. It has to be the keren, which is the horn. And it can't just come from any animal, because other animals have protrusions that come out of them, like a rhinoceros or a narwhal. But that's not called a keren. A keren is specifically only by ungulates, antelopes and deer and moose and oxen and all those things. So there's a discussion there about cows, whether they qualify or not. But the idea is that a keren is a bony protrusion that comes out of the head of a ungulate. And that's the same word that the Targum Onkelos is using for this word, etzem. So the Ramban says it's the same idea, that the keren also is the point in which all the strength, all the potential of the animal, the ram or the deer, whatever it is, the ibex, is being expressed. That helps us a lot, actually, to understand, perhaps, what this idea of shofar is all about. So again, the Ramban says a keren, right, these bony protrusions that sit atop the head, represents the all that potential energy that's inside that antelope as it goes running at 35 miles an hour and collides with a fellow male antelope, and that crash, that boom, has a resounding explosive sound which fills the savanna for whatever, a lot of area. You hear that explosive crack, that thing that, you know, when you hear it, it just gets down into your kishkas. That is the full expression of the potential energy which is stored up inside the animal. That's the word keren. Now, what's that have to do with us and a shofar? So when we're trying to understand what the shofar is, the first thing that we realize, we're talking so much about Rosh, the idea of a plan, the idea of an intelligence. The first thing we have to grab for something which is above the Rosh. The Keren is really the Keter. It's the crown of the animal. The crown always represents something which sits above the head, meaning that it's not our intelligence, it's not our grasp, our structure, how we see the world. It's the recognition that there's a higher intelligence, something above our head, that we're trying to grab onto, that we're trying to connect to, that the Keren expresses that idea. But more than that, that the Keren is the idea that we're taking all the potential that we've received, we're focusing it, we're concentrating it into one point. We're getting it all together. That's this idea of Tishrei, this idea of Rosh Hashanah. And what do you see when we take this Keren, and now we flip it around, and we take all of our stored potential, all of our life force, all that breath inside of us, and we breathe deep and we express it through one point, we're able to concentrate, we're able to constrict all of our potential and express it in one point. And of course, the idea of neshima, of breathing, is connected to the idea of neshama, that for a person, when we express our potential, it's not a physical force like an ibex. It's a spiritual force. It's our neshama that we are trying to get all that potential of our neshama and express it properly. That's why when we give this neshima and we put it through the small point, when we're able to focus all of that potential that we have, that potential energy, and express it out into the world, it cannot but make a tremendous impression on us and those around us. The sound of the shofar, that impression, it's a physical metaphor for the spiritual impression we make when we're able to take that potential Hashem's been giving us throughout the year, focus it on Rosh Hashanah, and turn around and express it out into the world. So from the Torah, this is a day of Truah. The word Truah really comes from the root with a Resh Ayin, right? Those two letters are really at the root. Horiu Kol Ha'amim, cry out all you nations. The word Truah comes from the root Ra'uah, the Resh Ayin root, which points to something which is lacking or missing. The ultimate point of Rosh Hashanah, when the Torah talks to us, is the realization that we are not the king over the world. We're crying out, we're screaming out, we're blasting out for Hashem to complete us, for something greater than us. It's the expression of our lacking, just like the blast of the shofar. It's the call to prayer, it's the call to war. It's always a call for something to help us, a recognition that we're not complete. But at the same token, our sages gave it another day, Rosh Hashanah, so that we shouldn't think we're so incomplete that we can't ever become greater. As a matter of fact, it's by recognizing that we're incomplete, by grabbing on to that higher completion, that we're able to change, we're able to become different, we're able to become greater. Now, to answer the final question, I think there were some questions that might have fallen through the cracks. The question about the first Mishnah, which is okay. But the question about where the name Rosh Hashanah does come up in Tanakh, which is in Yechezkel, in chapter 40 and verse 1. Why is the 10th of the month over there, Yom Kippur, called Rosh Hashanah? In what way does it express all those ideas that we've been talking about now? So if you go there, all the commentaries mention a chazal, a teaching of our sages. The question is, what 10th of the month is a Rosh Hashanah, right? Because we're assuming that a Rosh Hashanah, just out of common sense, should at least be the first of a month, and you know, we'll put the pieces together from there. So, tell us our sages that this wasn't any first of the month. This wasn't any 10th of the month. It wasn't just any Yom Kippur. It was a very special Yom Kippur. It was the Yovel year, the Jubilee year, which happens once every 50 years. If you go through there, all the different commentaries and the verse in Yechezkel, everybody puts together their different timelines, how we see, where we know that this vision is falling out during the 50th year, which is the Yovel year, this prophecy that Yechezkel is receiving. And it's important to note all the way also that this prophecy coming on the Yovel year in Tishrei is in fact a prophecy of the building of the final temple, of the future redemption. That's all coming in Yechezkel's vision, which he's receiving in the month of Tishrei, the month of head, the month of brain. So what's significant about a Yovel year that ties in so nicely with everything that we've been speaking about? Why is a Yovel year in some ways the ultimate Rosh Hashanah? Now, we didn't talk about it too much, but it's important to note that it's hard to separate Rosh Hashanah from Yom Kippur. you'll see that a lot of the commentaries really connect the 2 days. They're the beginning of a process. Anytime we see the number 10, 10 is always a process. As the Maharal likes to point out in many places, that when we count up to 10, and then it's something new, it's something different. 10 is a new level. At that point, we count with tens, right? Then it becomes a 10, a 20, a 30, and a 40. Whereas up to 10, it's individual numbers. 10 brings us to a level of tens. So 10 is a process where 10 is the completion of that process. That process starts on Rosh Hashanah. And as we recognize the kingship of Hashem, that actually brings us to a deeper level of kingship, which takes place on Yom Kippur. Because the first thing we have to realize that Hashem is the king. That happens on Rosh Hashanah itself. But then there's a higher level of kingship, which is that if Hashem is the king, well, are there other kings out there that we could maybe fall under their rule? So the recognition of a king, the acceptance of a king, brings about with it judgment, a day of judgment, a day of din. But the recognition that Hashem is the only king, so that means that Hashem has the ability to take us out of imprisonment from other kings. And the other king that we're speaking about, as the verse in Mishlei of Proverbs says, Zaken Echad, right? There's a Melech Zaken. There's an elderly king. He surrounds the city, right? That whole parable over there is talking about how the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, overtakes our physical body. So if Hashem's the true king, and he's the only king, that means that he has the ability to take us out from under the control, under the reign of the Yetzer Hara, and that's why on Yom Kippur, he's able to hand out pardons to free us from our slavery to the Yetzer Hara. We can leave the Yetzer Hara and go under Hashem's kingship. So it's no coincidence that the Yovel year, the Jubilee year, is a time when slaves go free and lands return back to their owners. All that falls out on Yom Kippur. This process is explained very beautifully in the Ramban and Emor that we've been speaking about. He says that Rosh Hashanah is a day of din berachamim, and Yom Kippur is a day of rachamim bedin. That is to say that Rosh Hashanah is the day of judgment, but again, here Hashem is the judge. So that means we're being judged with love, we're being judged favorably. And that process is a build-up until we get to Yom Kippur, which is rachamim bedin. It's a day of mercy, it's a day of Hashem freeing us from our bonds. But it has to be earned. There's an element of din to it. We have to do tshuva. We have to recognize Hashem as the king in order for that to work. So the Yovel year is the year where everything reverts back. So if we go back to our description of the idea of the year, which is the loop, the Shana, the Mishnah, and the fact that this loop has a Rosh. And if you think about it, if a person becomes an Eved Nirtza, a person decides he's going to sell himself into slavery. Now, if a person becomes an Eved Nirtza, that means he sold himself into slavery for life. They take his ear, they hammer it against, they hammer a peg into it against a doorpost, and that represents that he's a slave for life. Now, let's say he pulls the peg out, it wouldn't make a difference. He would still be a slave for life. Meaning at that point, once a person sells himself into servitude for life, he cannot undo it. He is stuck. So the person says, I'm hopeless. I will be a slave for the rest of my life. If a person has an inheritance, he received from his parents and their parents all the way back to when they left Egypt, and he needs money, so he sells it. Well, that inheritance isn't his anymore. And no matter how much kicking and screaming and begging he does, no matter how much money he throws at the person, if the person doesn't want to sell it to him, it is gone. So the Evid Nirza, the person who sells himself into slavery for life, the man who has sold his inheritance away, these people have no hope. They're stuck. They're trapped. There's no escape. But when the great shofar sounds in the Jubilee year, in the Yovel, the crying out, the recognition that there is a king that sits above us, that there is an intelligent design that Hashem brought certain lands to be with certain people. He took the Jews out of Egypt to be free and not to be slaves. Then everything reverts back to that plan. It goes back on track to the plan which Hashem had created. The Evid Nirza goes free. He's free again. The lands go back to their rightful owner. Now, certainly, people can mess it up again. A person can go back into servitude if he wants to. A person can resell his land. But the Yovel year is that power, that recognition, that when the redemption comes, when the final plan comes into place, Hashem is revealed as the ultimate king. We see that nature is not a loop. When the real king comes, then everything can always go according to his plan. So in that way, that idea in Yovel is the ultimate Rosh Hashanah, because it's the ultimate expression that there is one king with one plan that rules over this world. There's a Rosh to the Shana. And it was that idea that Chazal said, yes, this is what we want people to understand as they come to face the day of Din, the day of judgment. We don't just want them to think, Hashem, we're crying out, you are the king, we are lacking, we rely on you. It's an important thing, but then they also need to realize that that in itself is an ability to reach higher, to focus and express ourselves, to grab on to a higher point, and to change, to become something new and more complete. Wishing everybody a wonderful Rosh Hashanah, that we should all truly merit to feel the deep ideas that are represented in Shofar and the many prayers of Rosh Hashanah Day. And giving everybody blessings for a sweet and meaningful and productive upcoming year.